listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's Keziah Weir on books. Below the surface, incisive explorations of public persona and what lies beneath. Mr. and Mrs. Jones, in 1971, as a hairdresser in a suburb of London, Susie Ronson styled one Mrs. Jones and met the woman's son, David Bowie. Here, Ronson's memoir of creating his iconic Ziggy Stardust look, falling in love with his bandmate Mick, and life backstage. Published by Pegasus. The Swans of Harlem, from Vanity Fair contributor Karen Valby, an in-depth look at the Dance Theater of Harlem, founded in 1969 by Arthur Mitchell and Karel Shook. The spotlight shines on five of its stars, including prima ballerina Lydia Abarca. Published by Pantheon. Mean Boys, in 8 arresting essays, Jeffrey Mack probes culture and selfhood through lenses that include the spectacle of Art Basel, writing fashion sponcon, cruising bathhouses, and in the 100-page title essay, The Manifestos of Mass Shooters, published by Bloomsbury. Six-pack, eerie stories, marital strife, and more fresh fiction. The Sleepwalkers, Scarlett Thomas's sharp, stylish thriller, finds a pair of feuding honeymooners at a Greek hotel, where another couple's earlier disappearance looms increasingly large. Published by Simon & Schuster. Table for Two, from Amor Towles, a collection of 6 New York City-based short stories, plus a novella that revisits the thread of his 2011 debut, Rules of Civility. A young woman seeks her fortune in 1930s Los Angeles, published by Viking. The Garden, in Claire Beams's teeming gothic, would-be mothers with a history of miscarriage flock to a Berkshire's manor for experimental treatment, and a mysterious walled garden works its own strange magic, published by Doubleday. Real Americans, spanning 3 continents and as many generations, China's Cultural Revolution to San Francisco, 2030. Rachel Kong's precise, tender family history considers inheritance of all kinds, published by Knopf. The Audacity, a scammy startup, super yachts, Guggenheim as a verb, Ryan Chapman's delicious satire charts a career implosion that sends a husband to a private island and his wife into hiding, published by Soho Press. The Cemetery of Untold Stories, a Dominican author buries her unfinished manuscripts, but her characters are unwilling to go gently into that good night, in Julie Alvarez's inventive latest, published by Algonquin. My Stuff, Art Class. Fashion designer Duro Olowu creates a life as vibrant as his palette. From a rare book collection to perfectly clashing patterns. And there are photos that go along with each of these descriptions. Style file, daily uniform, cobalt green vintage French workwear jacket, Duro Olowu menswear rayon and silk shirt, and Christopher Namath denim black stitch trousers. Tailor, John Pierce, Meard Street, London. Vintage treasure, my large collection of antique West African textiles, particularly the embroidered Yoruba robes of my father and grandfather. Shades, Tom Ford. Neckwear, Turnbull and Asser navy silk twill polka dot scarf. Dress shirt, custom charvet. Socks, green or blue Uniqlo socks. For walking, K. Jacques Omer handmade sandals. Self-care, face wash, Sisley Paris. Cologne, Indelible by Friedrich Mahl. Sunday ritual, sleeping in. To unwind, visiting museum and gallery art exhibitions, wherever I may be. The Women in Revolt show, currently at Tate Britain in London, is a triumph on many levels. Also fantastic, Alaïa Gray Beyond Fashion at Fondation Azzedine Alaïa in Paris. At home, recent edition, Coffee Table by Max Schmidt, circa 1905, Vienna. Sketching in notebooks I collect from around the world. To illustrate, Faber-Castell graphite pencils and brush pens. Seating, Pierre Ouarichet ARP chair from Dimish Danant. On display, Maglan Odundo vessels. For pleasure, looking at Portrait of Space near Siwa, Egypt, 1937. Reading The Most Secret Memory of Men by Mohamed Moubghar Sarr and Out of Place, a Memoir by Edward Said. Doing shopping for rare books. Tinder Books or Kulik Seltzer are my favorite bookshops in London. Watching Herma Kono, Waiting for Happiness, directed by Abderrahmane Sissako, and La Haye des Anges, Bay of Angels, directed by Jacques Demy. Listening to Rufus and Chaka Khan. The menu, comfort food, Nigerian jollof rice with dodo. Dinner reservation, Maison Francois in London, served by the most professional and elegantly dressed staff. Moving on to travel, grow and behold. At a dazzling Maldives resort, plant-based Eau Cuisine puts a spin on surf and turf by Katie Nicol. Opening illustration by Yukieko Noritake, which shows an island with floating huts and other pavilions. There's something about arriving in style, skimming along turquoise waters toward Resort Gili Langkan Fushi aboard a golf craft touring 36 while sipping a lemongrass and champagne cocktail, one could be forgiven for imagining oneself a White Lotus guest. Located 20 minutes by boat from the Maldives' Malivelana International Airport, Gili gleams with white sand beaches, idyllic lagoons, and 45 villas made from sustainably sourced teak, palm wood, and bamboo. Ours has an open-air bedroom, a water garden where manta rays and baby sharks glide around, and a bathroom stocked with locally made organic toiletries scented in rosemary and peppermint. The Maldives has banned single-use plastic. 7 standalone Crusoe villas are lacking in shipwrecked sailors, but come with their own boats. The most opulent lodging, simply call the private reserve, sleeps 8, and cost $8,300 per night for your own gym, theater, spa, and water slide into the Indian Ocean. Executive chef Harnath Govindaraj, who oversees Ghee's three restaurants, recently introduced a chef's table vegan experience, joining the ranks of such plant-based fine dining establishments as London's Côté, Soho, and New York's 11 Madison Park. Doubling down on plant-to-plate fare is a logical addition for a resort known for its commitment to eco-conscious luxury. The garden is not just a part of the kitchen, but the heart of the kitchen, Govindaraj told Vanity Fair. My own family enjoyed a six-course meal made entirely of fruits and vegetables grown on the grounds of Gili Lankanfushi. Signature dishes include beetroot carpaccio, sautéed vegan scallops, radishes on a bed of wild mushroom risotto, and an ambrosial avocado soup. Composed of 26 atolls stretching across 500 miles of ocean, the Maldives also houses one of the world's most vibrant reefs. Aegilia's Coral Line project, 160 rows of coral, have been cultivated since Vaidotos Kirsis established it in 2014. The island's resorts range from the Cheval Blanc Rondelli, where the Prince and Princess of Wales have vacationed, to the Conrad Maldives Rangali Island, where Paris Hilton honeymooned in 2022. The Conrad of name happens to be her great-grandfather. But the beaches aren't just for couples. Some locations, like the larger Sonevajani, which our family of four also visited, are particularly kid-friendly. The swim-up bar at its children's center, the Den, serves ice cream, a zip line provides hours of entertainment, and the Director's Cut restaurant offers silent movie nights where headphone-clad kids watch Disney classics projected on a big screen lofted over the ocean. Back at Gili Lankanfushi, the concierge staff, dubbed Fridays, another Crusoe callback, can arrange fun for the whole family, from massages at the Mira Spa and sunrise yoga to surf lessons and private fishing trips with sushi making on board. The Overwater Bar, renovated late last year, offers panoramic sunsets and viewing platforms underfoot. Castaways be warned, the triggerfish are territorial. The no-bake chocolate avocado cake, addictive, and reality hits hard when it's time to go home. In memoriam, a hero of our time. In life, Alexei Navalny was warm, real, and human, the opposite of what and who he stood against, by Miriam Elder. I'm not ready for my son to become a martyr, Alexei Navalny's mother said these words in 2011, at the start of his journey to prominence as Russia's most active opposition politician. 13 years later, as news of her son's death in a remote Russian penal colony inside the Arctic Circle spread across the world, she said that she didn't want to hear any condolences. I saw my son in prison on the 12th when we went to visit him. He was alive, healthy, and cheerful. Navalny's team filled the void of his absence with similar calls. We have no reason to believe state propaganda. They have lied, are lying, and will continue to lie, wrote Leonid Volkov, a longtime associate of Navalny's. Don't rush to bury Alexei. Who could blame them? Everyone knew the stakes. Navalny had risen from anti-corruption activist to online superstar to grassroots organizer to Russia's most famous political prisoner. He had endured countless physical attacks along the way, including one in which the nerve agent Novichok nearly killed him. Navalny himself had addressed the possibility of his death in the Oscar-winning documentary that carried his name. Don't give up. You cannot give up, he says, straight to the camera, in the film directed by Daniel Roher. If it happens, if they decide to kill me, it means we are incredibly strong. We need to use that power. That begins by depriving the Russian state of the authority of defining his death. Navalny was a singular figure in Russia, though he would bristle at that description. He wanted to inspire through his example and empower average people to throw off the yoke of Vladimir Putin's tyrannical leadership, itself an inheritance from centuries of Russian imperial rule. If Navalny, the son of a couple who owns a basket weaving factory on the outskirts of Moscow, who studied law at a second-tier university, could come deeply in touch with his power as a citizen, couldn't anyone? When Navalny emerged in 2011 to become a leader of the massive street protest that swept Russia after Putin announced he was returning to the presidency following a brief stint as prime minister, his chants embodied that idea. We exist, he would yell to a crowd of tens of thousands. At one such protest, late in 2011, he sounded like a being from another planet, far from a Russia that had consolidated itself around one man. The only source of power is the people of the Russian Federation, Navalny told the crowd. The roar in response was deafening. Now he is gone. Killed. Perhaps in the moment, but certainly over the past few years of his imprisonment, by a regime that could not tolerate him. Putin tried and failed to murder Navalny quickly and secretly with poison, and now he has murdered him slowly and publicly in prison, wrote the exiled Russian opposition figure Garry Kasparov, and he could not be more right. Navalny grew an enormous following inside Russia by conducting thorough and easily digestible investigations into the corruption of the country's top elite, including Putin. He exposed shady deals, gaudy palaces, nepotistic excesses, and luxury yachts. After he was poisoned on a trip to Siberia, he, along with a journalist, Christo Grozev, called one of his own poisoners, an FSB agent, and got him to admit what he had done. His career in politics began on the street and then quickly shifted into something more. In 2013, he ran for mayor of Moscow and came in second. 3 years later, he tried to run for president but was barred. He founded an organization, the Anti-Corruption Foundation, which opened regional chapters across the country before being declared extremist in 2021. It now operates in exile. He launched a campaign to get Russians to engage in smart voting, casting their ballots for anyone but Putin's cronies in the United Russia Party. He was driven by one goal, to get Putin and his henchmen out of power. He made some serious mistakes along the way, including early engagement with nationalist anti-migrant politics and initial acceptance of Putin's seizure of Crimea from Ukraine, which he later renounced. Through it all, he remained unmistakably himself. Navalny was deeply serious about his work, but also quick to make a joke or flash a smile. This might not seem notable, but in Russia it was revolutionary. Russia's legacy did so much to degrade the country, including its language and the way people not well acquainted interact with one another. Listening to a politician or newscaster talk is often an exercise in acronyms, the passive voice, and language so technical it's as though they're talking about the intricacies of factory parts. Interpersonal exchanges are governed by suspicion or fear. In the photos, Alexei Navalny and his wife, Yulia Navalnaya, walk in a Moscow rally in 2019 to protest the assassination of Boris Nemtsov on the fourth anniversary of his death. And here was Navalny, comfortable in his skin, quick to call out the absurdity of any given situation. In the final video taken before his death, he appears gaunt, but still smiling, wisecracking with the judge, who smiles back. His life had become an endless series of court appearances and stints in solitary confinement, nearly 30. The Kremlin's legal onslaught against him began in 2013 with a politically motivated embezzlement case. It continued to grow, and after he returned to Russia following treatment in Germany for his near-fatal poisoning, he was arrested almost immediately. He was sentenced last year to 19 years in prison. There are so many questions to ask now. What does Navalny's death mean for Russia's embattled opposition, with so many in exile and others, like the writer Vladimir Karamurza and activist Ilya Yashin, serving prison terms of their own? What does it mean for the war in Ukraine? Navalny is but one man, and thousands of Ukrainians have been killed in Putin's ruthless invasion. What does it mean for U.S. policy as Republicans in Congress contort themselves into a neo-isolationist force staffed with nihilists whose one concern is keeping their leader, Donald Trump, off their backs? There will be time to ask those questions, but for now, a man is dead. As news of Navalny's death spread through Russian circles, I was struck by one thing. Far from Twitter and the posturing that platform encourages, people were filled with an almost unspeakable grief for Navalny's family. His wife, Yulia, his parents, his children, Daria and Zahar. I'm scared to even think what's happening with Yulia and the kids, with his relatives, the TV presenter Tanya Lazareva said, choking back tears on TV Rain, an independent channel that was forced into exile following Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago. Yulia Navalnaya had reluctantly taken up the mantle of her husband's work following his imprisonment. In the hours following the Russian prison service's announcement of her husband's death, she addressed the Munich Security Conference in Germany and vowed that Putin would be brought to justice. Putin has not addressed the conference in years, and he certainly never brought his wife, whom he divorced more than a decade ago. Since then, Putin has become the harshest version of himself, alone, paranoid, acting on his delusions of grandeur, and in doing so spreading suffering around the world, most horrifically in Ukraine. In that way, Navalny was his polar opposite, warm, real, and ultimately human. We dreamed he would be president of Russia, Mikhail Zigar, an exiled journalist and author, wrote on Instagram. For so long he was our future. Now we no longer have this future. There will be another one. And Alexei will always be with us. He will become more than a president. He will be the messiah of a future Russia. Now on to the royals. The King's Gambit. Margrethe II catapulted the Danish royal family to stratospheric heights of popularity. Her sometimes controversial son, Frederick X, faces a tougher road by Aaron Vanderhoof. When Frederick X became the sovereign of Denmark in January, he carved another name into a lineage that stretches back to the 10th century. Despite the weight of the history that came with the change, the official transfer of power happened after his mother, Queen Margrethe II, signed paperwork inside Christiansborg Palace. A photograph later released by the Kongresset depicted a low-key atmosphere. Somehow still heavy with anticipation, Margrethe holds a pen while Friedrich in full regalia Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen and now Crown Prince Christian look intently at her hand. It's a far cry from what happened with a new monarch and his council of state left the private room. A later video, set to Coldplay's A Sky Full of Stars, shows the Queen on the way to the Christiansborg balcony. His wife, Queen Mary, their three other children, Princess Isabella, Prince Vincent, and Princess Josephine, and his younger brother, Prince Joachim, watch as he walks out to meet the Prime Minister. At the palace complex, thousands of Danes gathered to bear witness, and in a brief speech, Frederiksen complimented the new king. The crown prince that now becomes our monarch is a king that we know, a king that we like, and a king that we trust, she said. For decades, the royal family of Denmark has been considered one of the most popular monarchies, and on this occasion it showed the world exactly why. Denmark has a population of about 6 million people, but as an economic and cultural power, it punches above its weight. It's the country responsible for both Legos and Hygge, and now a new royal couple is serving as its national ambassadors. In addition to their new king, the Danes now have a queen consort who can combine the constancy of Margrethe with a Kate Middleton-like track record as an advocate for children and a Michelle Obama-inflected talent for fashion diplomacy. According to Gertrude Daly, who runs the comprehensive site Gert's Royals, Australian-born Mary's official entrance to the family in 2004 made global royal watchers take notice. For one, the pair famously met at a bar during the 2000 Olympics in Sydney, which was reminiscent of the plot of a few different romantic comedies from around the same time. The Prince and Me from 2004, starring Julia Stiles, even set its royal fantasy story in Denmark. But Mary's favorable reception by the Danish public is a result of her embrace of the culture, which started when she learned the native tongue when she relocated there. Some other foreign spouses have not always taken as much of the initiative, because you don't need to. You can just speak English, Daly explained. But to learn Danish is very impressive. During her reign, Margrethe II captured the imagination of the press. Daly noted that one of Margrethe's greatest distinctions was her flair for the fantastic, citing Andy Warhol's 1985 portrait of her and her various personal creative pursuits. In the same way that Queen Elizabeth was known for inspiring admiration in even the staunchest Republicans, Margrethe's personality can be credited for the Kongresset's unusually high ratings with the Danish public. Since she announced her abdication on New Year's Eve, multiple news outlets repeated a shocking statistic. When Margrethe ascended to the throne in 1972, only 42% of the Danish public supported the monarchy. By certain measures, the number is now consistently higher than 70%. And in a recent poll, almost 92% of Danes approved of the job she did. Richard Milne, Baltic and Nordic correspondent for the Financial Times, notes that the abdication came at a moment of transition for the nation, buoyed by the success of its pharmaceutical industry. Denmark is a trading country, and right now its economy is completely dominated by drug maker Novo Nordisk, which is behind Wegovy and Ozempic, he says. These celebrity-endorsed anti-obesity drugs have taken off to an extraordinary extent, where the company's market capitalization is bigger than the GDP. Without Novo Nordisk, Denmark would be in recession. The Denmark that greeted Friedrich X's reign is a wealthy, happy, well-governed country. Though he has courted some controversy in the past for speeding infractions or his role on the International Olympic Committee, Friedrich arrives with a good reputation. He has been nominated for Dane of the Year in opinion polls at least once, and a poll taken after the abdication announcement found that just under 82% of the nation thinks he will do well as king. Due to strong public subsidies for journalism and a broad network of local outlets, the Danish press is less commercially driven than, say, the United Kingdom's media infrastructure, leading to very different coverage of the nation's royal family. Still, with a new reign come new risk. Though the Danish monarchy is known for avoiding scandal, the abdication follows two comparatively major ones. In late 2022, the royal family got into a public spat when Margrethe demoted Joachim's children with apparently little warning, stripping the heir titles of prince and princess and making them count and countess instead. Though the family argued about the issue in newspapers, the queen eventually apologized in a public statement, and they seem to have come to a reconciliation behind the scenes. Unlike when Prince Harry and Meghan Markle decamped to the United States, Joachim and his wife, Princess Marie, are still welcomed into the family fold. Though his primary residence is now in Washington, D.C., Joachim maintains his government job and role as a regent. In the photo, King Frederick X and Queen Mary of Denmark wave to onlookers following his proclamation in January. In November, another potentially damaging saga unfolded when Friedrich was photographed in Spain with Mexican socialite Genoveva Casanova. The Spanish magazine Lecturas published photos it claimed depicted them enjoying a stroll through a park, a Picasso exhibit at the Thyssen Bornemisza National Museum, dinner, and a flamenco show in Madrid. The aftermath led Casanova to release a statement denying any impropriety between her and the future king. "I flatly deny the statements that suggest a romantic relationship between Prince Friedrich and me," she wrote. "Any statement of this type is not only completely untrue, but also distorts the facts in a malicious manner." According to Ola, they were alone because another friend of Friedrich's fell ill with COVID-19 and had to cancel. Still, a conspiracy sprang into motion when Margrethe announced her plans to abdicate nearly 2 months later. Some royal commentators speculated that the move was a last-ditch attempt to save Friedrich's 20-year marriage to Mary. Though the story got some pickup in the Danish media, it didn't seem to represent a crisis, just as it didn't raise eyebrows when he went to Burning Man or was photographed hanging out with Post Malone at the Smukfest music festival back in 2015. For the last few decades, Friedrich's role as the heir to the throne meant that he was able to travel at will and develop a reputation as a free spirit. Now that he is king, however, he will have to turn inward and focus on Denmark. During his proclamation speech, he announced his new regal motto, emphasizing the crown's commitment to being on the same level as the people, united, committed for the kingdom of Denmark. The Danish appreciation for a bit of personality in kings and queens might be how a nation that prides itself on egalitarian values manages to keep a monarchy in the first place. In a 2002 ethnographic look at footage from a visit Margrethe made to a small coastal town, sociologist Richard Jenkins noted the queen was able to move between moments of formality and personable informality with great speed. In fact, the humanness of the Danish monarchy actually reflects a fundamental theme of Danish culture, that no one is better than anyone else. The royal family's ability to integrate regular citizens into their celebrations was illustrated best last year when the likely next king, Crown Prince Christian, celebrated his 18th birthday with a banquet that included around 200 young adults from across the nation as its guest. When one clever partygoer left behind a single shoe, the communications team at the palace knew it had a real-life fairy tale moment on its hands and posted a picture to its Instagram account. Daly proposed that other monarchies around the world might be able to learn something from the playful, even whimsical way the Kongehuset relates to the rest of Denmark. "It's the land of Hans Christian Andersen," she said. "It just has this fairy tale quality. I think they understand that, too." Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis, Bobby Brown, the beauty mogul on loyalty, lies, and a taxi driver named Marceau. What is your idea of perfect happiness, being at our beach house with my family in the Bahamas? Which historical figure do you most identify with? Queen Elizabeth II, small but mighty and deeply caring. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Being anxious about the small stuff. On what occasion do you lie? Is that handbag new? What do you consider your greatest achievement? Of course, my three boys, but also launching a new makeup company at 63. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Business school. Which living person do you most admire? My husband, who always seems to have everything in control and is so consistent. What is your greatest fear? Safety of loved ones. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Untruths, lies. When and where were you happiest? At each of my son's weddings. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My neck. What is your favorite journey? Jones Road. What is your greatest extravagance? Vacations. What is your greatest regret? I don't have any. Which word or phrase do you most overuse? That's so cool. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My husband, three sons, and granddaughter. Which talent would you most like to have? I'd love to be a great dancer. What is your current state of mind? Overwhelmed, but grateful. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I'd like to be more chill. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? A taxi driver named Marceau, who is a character in a children's book written by my dad, Joe Brown. Marceau uses and teaches imagination to save the world. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? They'd all live closer. What is your most treasured possession? My photographs. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery, knowingly hurting others and having no remorse? Where would you like to live? Right where I live now, but I've always wanted to get a London flat. What is your favorite occupation? Entrepreneur. What is your most marked characteristic? Naivete. What do you most value in your friends? Loyalty and liking to dance. Who are your favorite writers? Truman Capote and Linda Wells. Who are your heroes in real life? My parents, sister, and Aunt Alice. What are your favorite names? Dylan, Dakota, Duke. How would you like to die? I don't want to, but in my sleep, in a robe, at 120. What is your motto? I am me. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Bobby Brown. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.